Muddy Knees Media.
Totally Football Show Summer Special. Today, and a see you later as sparkling Sevilla send Roma Homer and roar into the Europa League quarterfinals, while Wolves pack the Germany 2 into the Europa League last 8 with that narrow 1-0 over Olympiacos. It's Sevilla for them next. How will Nuno's side fare? And what awaits Friday evening as the Champions League returns? Man City facing Real Madrid, Juventus hosting Lyon. We'll have our thoughts on that, plus Arsenal, why the Gunners are strapped and have given staff the bullet. All that and more in this Totally Football Show Summer Special in association with Paddy Power. Friday, the 7th of August. Met men say we're in for a scorcher, but we've got some cool heads for you here on your Totally Football Show Summer Special with Julien Laurens.
Hello, James. Hello, everyone.
Oof. Hello. And also here supplying some much-needed Euro flavour, Daniel Story.
Yes, James. Hello.
Daniel, you're in the Midlands. Jules, you're in Turin.
I am indeed, James. I've landed tonight for the game tomorrow between Juventus and Lyon.
Well, we'll catch up on all that later on as the Champions League gets back underway. But right now, the Europa League final 8 are sorted. 8 teams, 7 different countries represented. None of them are France, of course. But the big news on this Thursday evening is that Wolves are in there and due to be facing Sevilla, who put out Roma earlier on Thursday. Shall we start with events at Molineux? Jules, you saw this, did you? You were in Turin in time to catch this. A tale very much of two keepers, no? Bobby Alain and Rui Patricio.
You're right. We could summarize the game like this. I feel a bit for Bobby Alain, who's a French goalkeeper who moved to Olympiacos last summer from Dijon, who is a really, really good guy, one of the good ones, who has a very interesting story as well for the listeners who don't know. But both his parents are deaf. He learned at a very young age the language of signs because that was the only way he could communicate with his mum and dad. Otherwise, you know, it would have been very difficult. And I think he saw it as a gift, and that's the way he's explaining it as well when you speak to him. And he wanted to share that gift. So he's right now the goalkeeping coach, if you want, for the deaf French football team. He's also done a lot of courses for people who wanted to learn the language of signs and things like that. But tonight, I mean, he obviously conceded the penalty very early on in the game. He made a couple of good saves through the game, but it's true that one, I think, for his first game of the season as well, would not have gone the way he would have wanted, really.
Mm. This was him making his European debut because the first choice keeper, José Sá, was out injured. Daniel, it was a bit of a mistake for that early Wolves penalty,
yeah,
which proved decisive.
It was a really nervous first touch, which kind of sent the ball miles away from goal, and yeah, Daniel Pedence kind of spotted the opportunity to chase him down, and then he kind of compounds the error by, I guess, clumsily barging into Pedence. I think he went down pretty easily, but it was never going to be overturned because I don't think Alain was getting the ball, and it was so clumsy. And you did feel for him because he looked like he wanted the ground to swallow him up. And yeah, as Jules says, he did actually make some good saves, but that was the defining moment in the tie.
Absolutely. It was not long after that Olympiacos thought they got one back. But I guess from a Greek point of view, pretty controversial VAR call, saw that call back for offside. How did you feel about that?
Yeah, I thought El Arabi was, I think it was the right call, but it was very, very, I mean, there was not much at all in it. And I thought Doherty, watching it live on the television, I thought Doherty covered him. And it's only then with the line that you see that, okay, maybe for a few centimetres, El Arabi was just ahead. I was a bit disappointed by Wolves in the sense that I thought once they took the lead, I really thought they were going to control the game easily. And Olympiacos, who, let's be honest, are not a very good team. They did really well in Greece this season. And yes, they knocked out Arsenal, but they got quite lucky, I thought, in that game. And I really thought in that second leg that Wolves would walk over them. And I thought they show a bit of fragility, Wolves, that I didn't really see them this season or even last season, certainly not since Nuno you know, to cover, and since they've been in the Premier League, in midfield, Moutinho and Ruben Neves at times had no control at all on the game, and they conceded some big chances. I mean, Rui Patricio, as we said earlier, had made two huge saves, especially the header towards the end, that could have changed the games completely. So I was a bit disappointed by the lack of control. I thought they would control the game a bit more, and I think against Sevilla, they could be in trouble because of that.
All right. Daniel, what did you think? Was that slightly Wolves' plan to sit back and let Olympiacos come at them once they had the lead?
Possibly. I think what kind of undermined them is that Adama Traore had one of his hugely infuriating games. He has cut out those type of performances, I think, largely over this season, but the ball just wasn't sticking. You know, he was trying to take on his man and losing it. He was going to ground easily to try and win free kicks and not getting them. And I think that if that was Wolves' game plan, having taken the lead, it's kind of completely undermined when Traore doesn't play very well. It shows how reliant they are on him on the counter, because, you know, Jimenez is brilliant at holding the ball up, but he gets pretty isolated if Traore picks the ball up from deep and then loses it before halfway, which was happening more often than not. And that, as Jules says, that just invited pressure. It meant that the two central midfielders were kind of getting swamped as soon as Olympiacos won the ball back.
Jules, Matt Honeyman says that he spotted Karen Burr on the sidelines there alongside the Olympiacos bench, and has discovered that he's now a strategic advisor to the Greek champions. What does this entail?
He's a sporting director, okay. Basically. Yeah, that's what he means. I mean, I think he finished his career there, certainly played towards the end of his career, stayed in very good contact with the owner of the club, like François Modesto, who was his predecessor at the club, who also finished his career there, the French centre-back. And I saw Karen Burr. Maybe I'm a bit old-fashioned on that. I've got an issue with sporting director being on the bench. I don't think that's their position. I don't think they should even be allowed to be there. But we see with Salihamidzic at Bayern, for example, who is very often on the bench. And I'm struggling a bit, even from a manager point of view, to understand why you would want... I mean, maybe you don't have the choice, because arguably he's your boss. But still, to have him there, I don't know. It was a bit strange. And I did see him on TV as well, and I was surprised he was allowed on the bench.
Right. I must admit, I don't have strong feelings on the matter. Daniel?
No, not particularly. Right. It should be said that Olympiacos' owner is also the Nottingham Forest owner, and there's been some rumours, although it sounds like Sabri Amici is going to keep his job, there were some rumours that we might be looking at former Olympiacos managers as potential replacements.
Okay, what kind of...
Well, Marco Silva was Olympiacos manager. That was one name that was mentioned. I think that's probably slightly out of Forest's budget at the moment. And probably Marco Silva would prefer to go abroad to redeem that reputation. But yeah, it was interesting to see Marinakis in the stands, because I kind of, as a Forest supporter, you sort of forget that he's got a far more successful club than he also looks after.
If you're not yet a subscriber to The Athletic, take out a 30-day trial to see their unrivaled coverage of each and every Premier League club by heading to theathletic.com/totally.
Ojo, llega Reguilón pisando área, que sprint de Reguilón. Gol, 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 gol. Gol, 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 gol del Sevilla.
Jules, as you mentioned, it is Sevilla who Wolves will be facing, and they... A tough though Olympiacos proved, Sevilla might well be another level of opponent, particularly given their performance earlier on Thursday when they completely outplayed Roma. A 2-0 in a one-legged last 16 game away in Germany. Best side we've seen so far, Daniel?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, obviously they have the Europa League pedigree, and, you know, it should be said that Roma have been in some form, particularly away from home recently. I was impressed by Sevilla. I was actually more disappointed with Roma than I was impressed by Sevilla, I have to say. I think they probably will knock out Wolves, but that's a very tired Wolves. But I think Wolves will probably put up more of a fight than Roma did, which is strange because, as I say, Roma have looked pretty good recently. They just looked it seemed to me, if I hadn't have known, it looked like they were playing a pre-season friendly game rather than arguably the biggest match of their season.
Mm. Yeah, they look miles off the pace against a slick and speedy Sevilla side. The man who wrote the book on Sevilla and Sevillano football is Colin Miller, and he joins us now on the line for his reaction to their performance in Germany this Thursday and what they might offer against Wolves. Colin, thanks for joining us. First of all, that was quite something, that Sevilla performance Thursday evening.
Yeah, it was really, really dominant. It was really impressive. And I think that you guys on the pod have spoken in the past couple of weeks about what sort of teams would have the best advantage, I suppose, coming into these European matches in terms of when their leagues ended. And I think maybe you saw a little bit of that tonight. Certainly physically, I think Sevilla were much better than Roma. They were much sharper. Obviously, La Liga had ended 2 weeks prior to Serie A. But also, I think in terms of the tactical shape that Lopetegui implemented was really impressive too. They completely smothered Roma. They didn't give them a chance. And it was a really, really dominant performance, I think. Just through it, obviously, it was a 2-0 win, but it could have been more. You know, they hit the post twice. They had the Jules Koundé goal narrowly disallowed for offside. So, yeah, I think it's one of these performances from Sevilla that they always seem to produce at this end of the season. And actually, when I was last on the podcast, I said that Julian Lopetegui was actually under a little bit of pressure, but he's now guided them to 18 matches unbeaten in all competitions. And that's a Sevilla club record. It, I think, stretches back to 1935, which is before the Spanish Civil War. So this shows how much he's inspired them since the break. They've won 6 of their last 7 matches. Obviously, they're in the Champions League next season. But for Sevilla, the Europa League, as we all know, it's a very special competition for them. And if they can win another one of those, you know, that's going to make this a really, really successful season for them.
Well, the kind of pressure they put Roma under, do you see them bringing that to the clash with Wolves on Tuesday? How do you think that game's going to go?
It's going to be one of those games, like, we all know what Wolves are about, and they're going to be a very tough team to beat in a cup competition. But Sevilla are very similar in terms of the setup and how they play. The formations are a little bit different, but what's going to be really interesting in this game, I think, is going to be how Jesus Navas and Sergio Reguilón, who obviously scored that fantastic individual goal against Roma, how they get on. Because from watching the Wolves-Olympiacos game, I noticed that Wolves probably struggled a little bit to block out the crosses. And Sevilla are a team who really do like to use the width of the pitch. And Luke de Jong, who doesn't start tonight, is usually their target man, and they sort of centred around him. So it's going to be really interesting to see how Navas and Reguilón get on. And obviously for Wolves, it was a Johnny Otto went off with an injury in tonight's game, and they had to change it around a little bit. So how that pans out, I think, is going to be very important too. But yeah, I mean, this Sevilla, they're always going to be tough to beat. Lopetegui, his main goal essentially is to make his side really, really fluid, really, really competent in terms of how they understand each other and how they move about the pitch. And I think that was evident against Roma. Obviously, they had a little bit more time to prepare that, but I think they're going to be going into this Wolves game not under any false pretenses, but I think they're going to be confident that they can pull off another result.
At Sevilla, loads of people might be now tipping them for a 6th victory in this competition after the performance. You've seen so much of them. What flaws might there be? What might see them come undone between now and a potential final?
I think that Sevilla's main problem all season really has just been a lack of a goal-scoring threat in the final third. Their build-up play is very impressive, and they've got a lot of flair players, and the likes of Ever Banega in the middle of the pitch controls the game very well. But I mentioned Luke de Jong earlier. He didn't start tonight. He's only got 6 La Liga goals all season, and he's come out under a lot of criticism from Sevilla fans. A lot of people thought that Lopetegui had been too loyal to him. He's missed quite a lot of chances. They put in Youssef En-Nesyri, who was a January arrival, and again he's a player that's a bit raw. They don't have a 30 goal a season striker there, and obviously the one-off games, they're going to be a very sort of tight tactical battles over a couple of days. So it's going to be up to Lopetegui to sort of continue this momentum that he's built up, but I think they're going to be a very hard team to break down. We mentioned Reguilón and Navas and the fullbacks, but you looked at the center backs tonight. Diego Carlos, who's been linked with a host of Premier League clubs this summer, and I think he could go for big, big money if a club comes in for him. And Jules Koundé, who's a very, very promising French central defender as well, who's really, really impressed this season. So they're going to be very tough to break down.
Colin, I know you don't want to say it, but you know that all the success from Sevilla comes from France and from Ligue 1, obviously, and all the players that they get from us. You mentioned Koundé, and you mentioned Diego Carlos, and Lucas Ocampos again tonight, I thought was fantastic. I mean, I don't know what they give him to eat in Sevilla. I don't know if the food is different to what he had in France. I saw him arriving at Monaco when he was really young. Then he went to Marseille as well. And he had a good season last year in Marseille, but nothing like what we've seen this year. And, you know, when Wolves look at the Sevilla team and how to play them and how to counter them, really. I think if you can keep Lucas Ocampos quiet, I think you've taken a big part away of what Sevilla is about this season, because he's been so good for them.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Ocampos has been an absolute revelation. He's comfortably been one of the best La Liga performers in the entirety of the campaign. And I mentioned the lack of goal threat in terms of a central striker, but Ocampos certainly provides that. I think he's on 14 or 15 goals.
Yeah, 15, I think, yeah.
Yeah, across the campaign. He's really, really been impressive. And I think you saw tonight as well the sort of dynamism that he offers. He's direct, but he offers a threat from wide. He can go this way and that. He's really, really impressed. And you mentioned there as well, I think he's had five or six clubs, and he's only 24, I think. So this is a guy who's got a big future potentially ahead of him. He's coming into potentially the prime years of his career, and he really seems to have found his feet and found his potential at Sevilla. And again, it's like so many players, and you mentioned the Ligue 1 connection, and Diego Carlos as well came from Nantes last season. I wasn't aware of him at all, but he has been arguably the standout central defender in La Liga, alongside Sergio Ramos, you know, this season. I mean, he's just a rock. He's been so consistent. And I don't know exactly if it's the Lopetegui sort of coaching in terms of how he gets the best out of these players. And obviously, Monchi's meticulous and how his scouting network sort of brings in the best of European talent and further afield. But no, they've got an absolutely brilliant team this at the minute.
Colin Miller. As for Roma, I guess they really miss Chris Smalling, huh? Just one shot on target. In the meantime, from the Giallorossi, who do have some good news on this Thursday, or at least potentially it could be good news, because that new owner, Dan Friedkin, that James Horncastle was talking about in yesterday's show, that deal has now gone through for about £500 million. Absolutely massive. A measure, in fact, of how Roma's, you know, excuse the expression, global brand value has grown through the Pelotti years. And let's hope he has a little bit more luck kicking on with the new stadium, Dan Friedkin. Right. Oh, by the way, we discussed managers turning into goalkeepers a few weeks ago and how few of them there are. Just so happens that Tuesday's Wolves-Sevilla game will be an all-goalie gaffer game. So that's something else to look forward to.
That's true. Yeah.
Mm. Now, elsewhere on Thursday in the Europa League, Basel added another goal to their tally against Eintracht Frankfurt, going through 4-0 against the German side. On aggregate, they will be taking on Shakhtar Donetsk on Tuesday. And by Leverkusen, a goal for them from the electric Moussa Diaby, making their aggregate score against Rangers 4-1. No huge surprises there. Bayer will be playing Inter on Monday. And Man United will take on Copenhagen also that evening. So the quarterfinals all sorted. Man United, Copenhagen, Inter, Bayer, Wolves, Sevilla on Tuesday, and Shakhtar Basel. Who's your favourite, Daniel?
I think Manchester United are the favourites, not just because of the fairly handy draw they were given. I just think they're the team with the best players and in the best form, which is a pretty boring explanation, not particularly controversial, but it would be interesting if we can see them against Lukaku again. That would be a really nice story. And, you know, obviously Ashley Young, and there's so many former Premier League players into at the moment, that would be quite a nice story.
Jules, who are you tipping?
Just to be a bit different, I think I go for Sevilla. Yeah. I think that Colin explained it really well, that it's true that they like a big goal scorer, but I still think they've got a lot of talent, they've got good organisation, they've got a good manager as well. I think Inter would be in the mix too, and I would love to see Conte and Inter against United at some point, but yeah, I would go for Sevilla.
Good for you, Jules. Friday, the action will be switching to the champions as Juventus take on Lyon, watched by Jules, and Man City host Real Madrid. We'll be looking ahead to those games very, very shortly. Next up, though, 4 days on from the FA Cup triumph, let's check in on how the party's going at Arsenal, eh? Oh.
This Friday night, two bitter rivals finally meet. A grudge match that's been months in the making. It started in the boardroom, then went to the courtroom. It's Man City in the Champions League.
Yep, Man City are back in Europe, but here's a ruling that'll please all fans. Paddy Power have decided to give new and existing customers a £5 free bet on Friday's game versus Real Madrid. That's right, a £5 free bet on Man City v Real this Friday. Paddy Power. T's and C's apply. Online exclusive. New customers must deposit. One free £5 bet per customer. Opt-in required. 18+. BeGambleAware.org.
This is the Totally Summer Special by the Totally Football Show, part of the Athletic Podcast Network.
Arsenal staff, Saturday, all fired up from their FA Cup win. 4 days later, just plain fired. Wednesday, the club announcing redundancies for about 10% of their staff, including the majority of their scouting department. The players who'd taken that pay cut in April to safeguard jobs are said to be furious. Are they right? And does disbanding the scouting network leave Arsenal sleek and streamlined for the future, or just sucking at the teat of Keir Jarabchin and co? Here's James McNicholas, The Athletic's Arsenal correspondent. First of all, the issue of the players and this sense of betrayal, is that an unrealistic position for them to have?
I don't think so, because they'd agreed to take that pay cut in April. It was a 12.5% pay cut at the time. That's been cut down to 7.5% as a consequence of their qualification for the Europa League. And it wasn't necessarily easy for Arsenal to get that agreement over the line. It was unprecedented in the Premier League. They remained the first and only club to take a definitive cut to their wages rather than a deferral. And Mikel Arteta himself, the head coach, ultimately had to get involved, made a call to the team. And he spoke about the importance of the community, the club, the necessity of protecting other jobs. Consequently, when these redundancies were announced yesterday and the players were told after, I think, the all-staff call, which took place on Wednesday afternoon, there was some unhappiness from those players. And, you know, that has continued into today. You know, they feel, as far as we understand it, misled. From Arsenal's perspective, they say that this is a fluid financial situation. You know, that what they thought in April about what they might be able to do as regards jobs and the projections at the time is not necessarily true today. And it is certainly the case that if you look at all businesses across many industries, there will be restructuring, there will be people losing jobs, as difficult as that is. I think the reason that it rankles with, I think, sections of the Arsenal fan base is this is a club with a billionaire owner in Stan Kroenke and KSC, with the capacity to, if they were inclined, essentially make up the deficit here that Arsenal will save by losing these jobs. And I do have enormous sympathy with that point of view. It's clearly quite an emotive one, I think, for a lot of supporters as well.
So what about the second issue then, about the kind of jobs that are going, the head of scouting, various heads of regional scouting, with the sense that the club is increasingly moving to the opinion of, well, in the popular caricature, one man, Keir Jarabchin?
Well, I think this is a fascinating development. Most of the jobs that Arsenal expect to lose in this redundancy period, they say, are in kind of administrative and commercial departments. But clearly, the most high-profile redundancies have been on the scouting side, principally Francis Cagayao, who is the head of international scouting, or at least was the head of international scouting. He's been with the club for 24 years, was a lieutenant to Arsene Wenger, Steve Rowley, is credited with spotting players like Hector Bellerin, Cesc Fabregas. He was involved in the pursuit of Gabriel Martinelli, who, of course, was a breakout star last season. Arsenal have lost two other very senior scouts in Brian McDermott, the former Reading and Leeds manager, and Peter Clark, who is their head of UK scouting. This was all on Wednesday morning communicated to them. And then as Thursday's played out, hour by hour, more regional scouts who were on kind of consultancy arrangements with Arsenal have been told their services will no longer be required. Now, that is not necessarily hugely unusual at the present time. You know, we understand a lot of clubs in Europe, given the financial landscape, will be making cuts to their scouting team. But we have not encountered anything quite on this scale. And I think when you set that up alongside some of the business Arsenal have done, we're all aware, I'm sure, of the stories regarding Willian, and we understand that is a deal that Arsenal do want to press ahead and do want to do. His agent is Keir Jarabchin, as is David Luiz, as is Cedric Suarez, represented by Keir. You know, it does make you wonder about how wide the pool of players Arsenal are recruiting from really is.
Hmm. Scouting is obviously pretty important to any club with major ambitions. Hmm. Do you think we're going to be seeing, by the sound of it, a lot more of this kind of thing from other Premier League clubs?
That's a really good question. And all I would say is that Arsenal, as I say, asked their players to take a pay cut. They remain the only ones to do so. And I imagine other Premier League clubs will be looking at the backlash to Arsenal's decision and maybe thinking twice if there's another way that they could save maybe the few million pounds that these redundancies will ultimately reserve for Arsenal.
From Arsenal's point of view, how would they frame this decision?
There is a sense in which, of course, like these redundancies are driven by the economic situation created by COVID-19. But you can look at it and say maybe Arsenal have sort of taken that opportunity for a bit of a restructure. It does seem like the scouting department was undergoing, you know, a degree of review by Edu, who's an incoming technical director. And there is a potential that he will want his people in place. So I guess I agree with your view that having a good scouting department with connections in many different areas is absolutely key to that. And Martinelli's a great example. You know, he was playing in effectively the fourth tier of Brazilian football. These guys, there isn't really the data on them. There isn't really the analytics on those people. He had to be discovered by scouts on the ground, watching him play in the flesh. And Arsenal, if they don't have the resource to do that, well, that could be a big problem for them.
Well, what a shame. Just a few days after, I think a lot of supporters felt that things were moving in the right direction again. This certainly doesn't feel like it's the right direction, but maybe I'm being unfair. Daniel?
I think there's two separate points here. One is, if this is to do with a kind of overhaul of the scouting department, then that's clearly a direction which Arsenal are perfectly allowed to take, probably free from extreme criticism, I think, or at least withholding that criticism until we see what the overhaul comprises of. I think the thing that sticks in the throat of Arsenal supporters is that they kind of sold this as a, you know, your club needs you, we've all got to stick together, times are hard, it's hard for us as well, slightly small violin playing with the statement, because that doesn't really stack up when you've got an owner worth $8.3 billion and you're also negotiating reportedly with both Willian and Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang for kind of bumper contracts. I think that's what sticks in the throat a little bit. And the sense, as you allude to, that 4 days ago, everything seems rosy and supporters are getting a little bit tired of the suspicion that there's nothing quite like Arsenal for tripping over their own feet just as good news arises on the horizon.
Mm-hmm. On the subject of Stan Kroenke and his ability to shore up the club financially, presumably FFP would have some kind of bearing on that. Owners aren't allowed to just cover debts or make up shortfalls financially.
No, although Arsenal are one of the most profitable clubs in the Premier League, they are clearly going to be restricted in the transfer market. But I think it's probably fair to say that the reported just under £2 million they're going to save per year from these redundancies are probably not the biggest sway in that. Maybe paying Willian £6 million a year might be, or whatever cut Kia Durabchin takes of that. But no, I don't think that's the big thing.
And unfortunately, could well be the first of many such stories at clubs in the Premier League and beyond. Well, after this, let's move on to the return then of the Champions League Friday evening. Two games, Real Madrid at Man City and Juventus Lyon. The winners of those two matches will be facing each other in the quarterfinals. Ooh.
You're listening to the Totally Summer Special by the Totally Football Show, sponsored by Paddy Power.
Jules, are you pumped for Man City Real Madrid?
I am. Yeah, I am pumped.
No, you're not, because you've actually travelled all the way to Turin, where you won't even see it, because you're going to be... These games are happening at the same time, aren't they?
Yeah, I'll have a screen with the City Real Madrid game, and I'll have an eye on the pitch in front of me for the...
All right. Well, let's come to Daniel then. Daniel, Real Madrid... 2-1 down, and that's two away goals for Man City. Ordinarily, Man City being Man City, you'd consider this unlikely, but perhaps not in this case, because Real Madrid are Real Madrid.
Yeah, and they're a Real Madrid that's in a very different bill of health than when the first leg was played. You know, before that, they'd lost to Leganés, they'd got knocked out of the Copa del Rey by Real Sociedad, they'd drawn with Celta Vigo at home, they were second in La Liga behind Barcelona and a kind of creaking Barcelona. And it felt like a pretty devastating blow to lose that lead and lose the home leg. But yeah, they're in a completely different frame of mind now, having in the end kind of cantered to La Liga title. And we know Zidane's history in this competition. We know that he considers the kind of backs against the wall attitude that that his players have shown him over the previous 3 or 4 years, and he'll be looking to see more of it. I think we can kind of put the tie down to one thing, and that's who scores the first goal, quite frankly. You know, Manchester City have lost, they've lost 6 of the last 7 games in which they've conceded first. The only exception of that was the first leg in Madrid. And there just seems to be a fragility about them that when things go wrong, they're unable to cope with that. And it, you know, any Real Madrid goal in the first 20 minutes, I think, on Friday, and they will start to creak again, particularly with no Sergio Aguero.
Right. No Sergio Ramos, meanwhile, for Real Madrid. But Eden Hazard could be back, apparently, in full training now for the Merengues. City have kept just 2 clean sheets in their last 11 Champions League knockout games under Pep Guardiola. What about Guardiola and the Champions League? It's been a slightly disappointing season, even though they finished runners-up in the Premier League, but missing out on the FA Cup. This is the tournament that he hasn't won since back in the Barcelona days, 2011. This is the big target.
Yeah, I think this is. I think it was from the beginning, really. I really wonder if he knew that having another season at 95 plus points, like the last two, he knew that that was impossible. I think that the psychologically, the demands that that takes on, the degree of excellence, the performances that you have to put out through the whole season to be able to have another third season like that in a row. I wondered if he knew how difficult this would be, and that the title, unless Liverpool had a really average season, that it was not for, you know, it was not for City, and that in that case you could focus on Champions League in a much easier way if you want. And I think, again, as much pressure as that adds to Guardiola and to the players, but especially to Guardiola, I still maintain that that was the big priority. I think he would give anything to win this Champions League again. Whatever way he does it, regardless of who he faces in the semis, in the quarters, in the final, you know, I don't. If he wins every tie on penalties, he would be as happy as when he won it in 2011 and 2009, when they were by far the best team in Europe. So I just think that I wonder how he's approaching this game. I wonder if he's overthinking it, like often he does, or if he thinks, you know what, we're in the lead now, which was not the case after the Spurs game last season, after the Liverpool game the season before. And if he would go in a more simple way, okay, I'm going to put Gabriel Jesus in his normal position, and I would put Mahrez in his normal position, and Sterling as well, and I'll have a midfield three, and I'll have a back four with Laporte and Fernandinho, and instead of trying to think or overthink what he could do or what Zidane will do and who Zidane will play in midfield, and if he does that, then I can do this and this and that, and then maybe that would work this time.
Maybe so.
I think there's obviously an interesting thing in terms of central defenders, because he was playing Eric Garcia quite a lot towards the end of the Premier League season. It was, he admitted on Thursday that Eric Garcia is looking to run his contract down at Manchester City and either leave on a free, or presumably they would now be prepared to sell him this summer, which does, as Jules kind of says, that at least that kind of limits his options for overthinking that defence, which is generally the area of the pitch that he does overthink it. It kind of figures that it has to be Laporte and Fernandinho now.
Who's going to get the first goal, Jules?
I think City will be on the front foot, even if they're in the lead. I think they will. I think they will look to have the ball and create chances. I do think that Real Madrid built their success this year on how strong defensively they were, and a lot of that was down to Sergio Ramos. And I think the worst thing that could happen to them, even more maybe than Karim Benzema being out, was to have Sergio Ramos out for this game, really. And that red card in the first leg, I think, could cost them massively in the second leg, because whoever Zidane picks to replace him, whether that's Eder Militao or Nacho, both of them have weaknesses. They have, you know, cons. Nacho has been injured so much. I think Eder Militao at times have been a proper liability. So whoever you pick, it could bring a lot of fragility to your defence. And I think that's maybe where the game would be won or lost, I guess.
Karim Benzema, though, eh?
Hey, best player in La Liga this season, I'm telling you.
Will he be the best player Friday night? Alrighty. Oh, just on the subject of Man City, I read that David Silva reports that he might be heading to Lazio. That transfer is now beginning to take shape, which means he would be back in the Champions League next season for the Biancoceleste. All very, very interesting. Meantime, also taking place Friday night, and the game you're in Turin to see, Jules, is Juventus-Lyon. Can Lyon complete the upset that they began back at the Groupama Stadium in February? And we'll discuss that very, very shortly. First of all, though, here's Lee Price of Paddy Power.
Thank you. Hello. Yes, Champions League is back, and I should never be surprised Man City are odds on to win. They do beat most people, including UEFA, but even so, they are up against the Spanish champions. Still, two away goals are pretty handy, isn't it? And we're 4-6 that City win this leg two. It's priced at 1-10 that they go through. We're very confident about Manchester City. Real Madrid are 10-3 to win on the night and 11-2 to go through overall. It'd be some turnaround for them. But things are closer in the other Friday night match. Juventus are 2-5 to win the second leg, with Lyon priced at 7-1 to take it. So that's pretty one-sided. But the betting on who will qualify is a lot closer. Juve are 20-23 to go through, Lyon are 9-10, which means we favour the Italian side by less than 1%. Crikey. Should be worth watching.
You can find out these odds and more at paddypower.com or the Paddy Power app. Prices are accurate at the time of recording. It's over 18s only. Terms and conditions apply. And when the fun stops, stop. Now, Jules, Friday night in Turin, Lyon 1-0 up from the home leg. We'll be taking on Juventus again. And what is in store for us here? Lyon, first of all, they've had one official game, one proper competitive game in the last, what, 5 months now, is it?
Yeah, exactly, James.
How have their preparations been for this?
I mean, I thought they played well against PSG in the League Cup final last weekend. They lost on penalties eventually, but I thought they defended really well with the back five, which I think Rudy Garcia would play exactly the same team on Friday night with a back five, like he did in the first leg as well. I think they prepared to defend deep and to defend well and to work hard for each other, not to give too much away to Juventus and especially to Cristiano. I think they know that if Paulo Dybala is fit to start, and if he isn't, we'll have a huge, obviously, impact on the game and also on their own performance. You could maybe expect, if Dybala is not playing, to play slightly higher up on the pitch and maybe have a bit more of the ball and see what you can do with it. But they certainly believe that they can do it. They've seen Juve in the last few weeks being tired, not being very good defensively, as we said, potentially with key players missing. And I think they fancy their chances, not to go and win 3-0 in Turin, but certainly to frustrate Juve enough to bring a bit of doubt in their minds, in Sarri's mind as well. They know how under pressure Sarri is. And they also know that if Dybala is not playing, if you defend well on Cristiano, which won't be easy, but certainly when Dybala isn't there, it's more of an individual game from Juve's point of view. And individual, it's only him really, Douglas Costa is also out. So you can really think, okay, if you keep Cristiano quiet in the game, if Dybala is not playing, then you'll be close from going through. So it's very interesting to see how, when the draw was made, they were like, okay, well, we've got no chance pretty much over the two legs. Now, they played really well in that first leg, rode their luck a little bit in that second half for one goal lead, and suddenly Memphis Depay, who should have never been playing this game because he had that big knee injury in December, is now back, firing, in great shape physically as well. And with him, it's a completely different Lyon team as well. So I can see why they believe.
I mean, the Juve, they do look a different side to the one that Lyon would have anticipated facing. They score goals, but they concede loads, as you know we've been discussing. And Memphis Depay, Moussa Dembele up against them, it does look like a really dangerous game. On the subject of Paulo Dybala, word on Thursday, he is unlikely to start. Cristiano Ronaldo, meanwhile, with that big Champions League heritage and desperate, one would imagine, to feature in the final eight in Portugal, his manner. 31 goals so far this season, Jules.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, he bailed them out against Atletico last season, and you just cannot say that he cannot win with them the game. I think there would be a lot of pressure on him. It's 24 years now that Juventus haven't won the Champions League. They've lost all those finals. He was clearly bought in for that. And for him as well, personally, if he was to win the Champions League with Juve, he would become only the second player in history after Seedorf to win the Champions League with three different clubs. So it would be a hell of an achievement. I think he knows that. I think Juve knows it. this is a tie that they should go through. They should win, really. I don't care what happened in the first leg. I don't care that they're tired. I don't care if Dybala is not fit to start. This is a game they should be winning and go through to the quarterfinals in Lisbon, which obviously would mean a lot to Cristiano. So I still think they're favourite, but there's something in what how they've been playing, in the relationship between Sarri and his dressing room, even in Cristiano's frustration at times since the restart, for sure, that make you think that there's also a bit of negativity around for them.
Right, 3 wins in their last 9 matches. They've lost 3 of their last 4 in the league. Daniel?
Yeah, I mean, just to put Ronaldo's Champions League knockout stage brilliance into some context, he scored more Champions League knockout goals than every other player in history, bar Messi and Raul, have in the competition as a whole. So it's a very obvious thing.
So sorry,
thing
more
say.
Goals in the knockout than every
more goals in the knockout stages than anyone else has in the competition as a whole, bar Messi and Raul. 65 goals, which is astonishing, and it's almost as if at this stage it becomes. We know he's an individualist. We know he has his incredible ego and a deliberate ego to kind of fuel this overperformance. But he can become only the second player to win 6 Champions League trophies after Gento at Real Madrid, which is obviously a long, long time ago. And he'll be thinking about that. He really will. He'll be thinking about. You almost get the sense that he would almost prefer Paulo Dybala not to be there, so he could kind of drag them through by himself. And that is incredibly powerful for a manager like Sarri, who's under pressure, because he kind of can pass all that pressure on to Ronaldo. Everyone will be looking at Ronaldo, not him, for once, and with all the pressure kind of building in the Italian media around him. So, yeah, I think he will. I do. I think he'll score twice and they'll do it again.
All right. Juve, who've been knocked out of this competition at the quarterfinal stage in the last 2 seasons, but in danger of not even making it that far this time around. A huge Friday night then between that game and the clash at the Etihad. And of course, we'll be back to review what happens in those and look forward to Saturday's lineup, which is a bit spiffing too. Do make sure you join us for that, listener. For now, many, many thanks to Daniel Story and to Julien Laurent.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And to Colin Miller and James McNicholas and producer Charlie, who stayed up all night literally doing this, listener, for you. Have yourself a great Friday. We'll be back with you soon.
You've been listening to The Totally Football Show, part of the Athletic Podcast Network. Keep up to date with everything Totally at thetotallyfootballshow.com and follow us at The Totally Show on Twitter and Insta. Check out all of The Athletic's football podcasts on Apple, Spotify and all the usual places, or listen ad-free on the Athletic app. The Totally Football Show is a Muddy Knees Media production and sponsored by Paddy Power.
Muddy Knees Media.